As 2015 comes to a close, we're taking a look back at some of the discussions we brought you throughout the year. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WSF Public Media, I'm Carson Cooper. On today's show, we're bringing you highlights from some of our shows from throughout the year. Same-sex couples have been able to marry in Florida since January 6, 2015, and on June 26, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that same-sex marriage is legal nationwide. We took a close look at that ruling with Clearwater attorney Alan Gassman, who wrote the Florida Legal Guide for Same-Sex Couples, and Mike Reedy of Equality Florida.
You know, this has been a long fight for many people, and as someone who is maybe of a younger generation, I feel like I am the end of the relay race, the last one to get the baton. But we've seen couples that have been together for 62 years that were able to get married and to be recognized and finally feel that all of the work that has happened over the course of the many decades is finally paying off. Retrospectively, we also were receiving emails. I remember I received an email from a gentleman just 3 days before the January 6th decision in which he was congratulating us, but was sad because unfortunately his partner of more than 40 years passed away just 2 days before that decision, which means that they were not able to get married. They were not able to share many of those benefits. And that's exactly what we fight for. We fight for the good news, and we also fight for those that unfortunately didn't get to see it through.
So, Alan Gassman, what are you hearing from your clients or prospective clients?
Well, my clients are wondering whether they should get married. They're wondering now whether their joint assets, which we call as owned as tenants by the entireties, are creditor proof, the way Florida protects certain joint assets that are titled originally to a married couple. If their marriage wasn't recognized by Florida at the time that they got married by another state, are that those assets probably need to be reconveyed now in order to be protected from a creditor standpoint. I have couples who are in two separate homesteads in the same county, and now that they're married, the property appraiser is going to take away one of their homesteads. So there's a lot of different technical issues. I have clients who are going to get married and pay a lot more Medicare tax because the exemption is $200,000 a year per person if you're single, but $250,000 a couple if you're married. So it's a lot of technical things going on.
And we should certainly point out that this applies to all married couples, the loss of a homestead when you get married and so on. So it affects everyone. Because marriage is legal in all states, I would assume that it's true divorce is legal too. Is that correct?
Divorce will need to be recognized now in all states. Now, of course, they
is that automatic or does it need to be spelled out?
Oh, I mean, that is fairly automatic. If a state is recognizing a marriage, then it will also recognize the divorce. I'm interested, actually, Alan, are you seeing any increase in business since January, maybe from same-sex couples, more than what you had prior to 2015?
Yes, since January, because they, you know, are able to basically come out and be public about their relationships. People, beyond the legal aspect here, there's been a lot of, you know, professionals in the Tampa Bay community who have had to keep their relationships, I'll use the clause in the closet, for decades. And in January, a substantial percentage of them felt comfortable socially and professionally coming out and feeling that they would not be discriminated against by their own clients, their own customers, their own colleagues. So it's been a touching situation.
According to data posted on the state's Child Fatality Prevention website, more children have died in Florida this year than before the overhaul of its child welfare system in 2014. In about a quarter of those deaths, the Florida Department of Children and Families had prior contact with the family. We sit down with DCF Secretary Mike Carroll to discuss how the department is trying to do a better job protecting children.
I got to tell you, the kids most at risk in this state are the youngest kids, 0 to 3. And we've moved our focus to really begin to drill in on that population. And if we have young moms or young parents that show up that have a behavioral health issue, a substance abuse issue, have no experience parenting a child, then those kids are at risk. And we have to find a way to intervene in those families earlier. And we have to find a way to make sure that the acuity of our services, the intensity of our services, matches what issues these folks come in with. To think that I'm going to deal with a 20-year-old parent who themselves was a victim of abuse and neglect, who now has a substance abuse issue, who now has a paramour who is violent, who himself has a drug issue, and to think that we're going to take these and deal with these families and send them to a class, and that's going to fix it, it's unrealistic. There are some deep-rooted, deep-seated issues that are driving this. And what I hope is, and I don't mind the scrutiny because I think the department needs to be open to the scrutiny. If we screwed up, we ought to be the first ones out there saying what we did and how we're going to fix it. But we've got to get the conversation to a place where we start asking, why do we have so many parents in this state who do not have the capacity to parent for their kids? And why on earth do we have so many parents in this state that kill their children? Because until we begin understanding what's driving that issue, all we're doing in the department is providing Band-Aids. We're responding, and we're trying to keep kids safe. But we can't remove every child. You know, as a result of the legislation that passed last year, our removal rates are up. We got a significant increase in our budget last year because our removal. And when I say removal rates, I mean we're taking more kids out of their homes and placing them in foster or adoptive homes.
Is Florida an outlier among the states as far as these types of cases? Parents who kill their kids, as you pointed out.
That's difficult to say. Another frustration of mine in child welfare is nothing's done the same around the country. So Florida is very progressive in the way we track child fatalities. So, for instance, if you looked at the child fatality website in Florida, we're one of the only states. In fact, we've had several states come to us trying to emulate our child fatality website in their state to make it very public.
Mm-hmm.
But it's clearly, if you look at a child fatality website, it clearly points to child fatalities as being a public health issue. In the state of Florida, we get about 450 reports called into the hotline every year that involve a child fatality. 450. To me, that's an outrageous number. But when you look at it more deeply, the leading cause of death is unsafe sleep. Where there was not an intentional act, it was either a parent co-slept with a baby or they were put in an unsafe crib or they were put on a couch. There are times when folks co-sleep with a child and they're on substances. You know, to me, that's neglectful. To me, that should be a crime. That's no different to me than driving under the influence. Second leading cause of death in Florida is child drowning. Some of that is directly associated with minimal parent oversight and supervision. And the third leading cause of death for children called into the hotline is SIDS, SUIDS, or some other natural cause of death. I say that because if you go and you compare our child death or our child fatality numbers with other states, most states don't report those type deaths to their hotline. There has to be abuse and neglect expected. And so a lot of times when other states report, they only report out on inflicted trauma deaths.
So it is one is too many.
One is too many. 450 to me is an absolute red flag for this state that we have a public health issue around children and child deaths in this state.
Now, DCF works with local child protection agencies. Mm-hmm. Is that a good relationship around the state? How does DCF work with local agencies?
I think the misnomer for a lot of folks is whenever you see the press or folks talk about child welfare, it's easy to say DCF. The fact of the matter is child welfare is really a big network of folks, public and private, that work together to keep kids safe. So it's really this big safety net. And the key is to make sure that they're all talking to each other and sharing information, rowing in the same direction.
Mike Carroll, Secretary of the Florida Department of Children and Families, it's always good to see you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
You can take a second listen to any of our shows online at WUSFnews.org. Just click on the Florida Matters link. Coming up,
Sarasota is a very wealthy community. It's a beautiful place to live, but half of the kids in our school district are on free and reduced lunch. Poverty is a growing problem, and affordability of housing is a really big issue here.
I'm Kirsten Cooper. This is Florida Matters. I'm Kirsten Cooper. This is Florida Matters. As the year ends, we're taking another listen to some of the conversations we brought you throughout 2015. Groups that work with the homeless say summertime means an increase in need. In July, Florida Matters' Robin Sussingham sat down with the panel to talk about homelessness among Florida students. And Florida Matters' Michael S. Butler introduced you to a mom and her two kids who were getting help from an organization in Pinellas County.
About a dozen kids are playing in a large room at the Homeless Empowerment Program, or HEP, in Pinellas County. Most are busy gluing plastic bottle caps into different shapes to make art. There are boys and girls. All are between the ages of about 6 to 12. Noah Holmes is 12. His family is now staying at HEP, and he remembers the hotel, the last place where he stayed with his mom and little sister. And he can describe it in just one word.
Bad. You can't go at least 10 feet without smelling weed or pot or something. Just the place was bad.
Michelle Holmes is mother to Noah and 7-year-old Emma. The family was evicted from their apartment not long after she lost her job. Her pastor recommended she call HEP. When we talked, they had only been at the shelter for about a week.
Without this, like I said, I don't know where we'd be. I don't know. Like, I don't want to say ever living on the streets, but that may have been our next step.
Holmes says she's noticed a difference in Noah since their housing worries started.
With Noah, his demeanor has changed a little bit. He's very pouty and quieter. I definitely think it affects them at school. They're like, I don't think they know how to express what to tell everyone.
A study from the American Psychological Association says as schooling for homeless children is interrupted or delayed, they are twice as likely to have a learning disability, have to repeat a grade, or to be suspended from school. Michelle Holmes says the Pinellas County school system knows that the family is staying at HEP.
And they were very supportive of like the situation. If we were late, because getting her on the bus, she missed a couple days because they were getting her a bus from the hotel. Then they really worked with her well.
So how many students like Noah and Emma are there? Well, the exact number is hard to determine. According to 211 Tampa Bay Cares, there were around 2,200 homeless students in Pinellas County. The term homeless students has a broader definition than you may think. It includes students who are living in trailer parks, hotels, or with extended family. And it can be difficult to get an accurate count of homeless students, especially as they get older when they start to couch surf or move around a lot. Across the bay, Ken Gaughan supervises social work for Hillsborough County Public Schools.
We've also been talking to other communities and kind of experts in the field about what should our number be? You know, what does it look like?
He says they've been trying to figure out how many homeless students they may have.
And the input we get is you need to look at your free lunch count in the district. And our free lunch count is pretty high. It's around 55%. They say about 10% of your free lunch population is also homeless. That's a pretty big number.
Doing the math, that means about 11,000 students in Hillsborough County may be at or near homeless.
Well, what are you making out of your bottle caps?
Okay.
Meanwhile, Noah Holmes says he's just glad his family's together at the Homeless Empowerment Program, and he hopes it means a fresh start for all of them.
I don't know, helps my family get back on our feet instead of just keep falling and falling.
So you just move up from where we used to be.
His mom is going through a 6-week computer training class at HEP that she hopes will improve her chances at finding a good job and a permanent home of their own. For Florida Matters, I'm Michael S. Butler.
So hearing the sadness there in Noah's voice in Michael's report, that's tough. But there is hope. The good news is that homelessness in Florida overall is way down. And although the homeless student population is still on the rise, it's starting to level off. The Florida Council on Homelessness credits strong community participation as being key to getting families into their own homes. We have representatives of those community organizations that are making a real difference here with us. Zach White is the Senior Director of Programs for the Homeless Empowerment Program in Clearwater. Thanks for being here, Zach.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, Zach, we heard our reporter speaking to 12-year-old Noah and his mother at the HEP campus. What typically happens to families that they slip into homelessness?
What might contribute to a family's homelessness could be a variety of things. You know, it could be economic downturn, loss of income, employment, it could be disability, substance abuse issues, broken homes. It could be a multitude of factors.
Jamie Meyer is also here in the studio with us. Jamie's the Senior Director of Education Services and Programs for Metropolitan Ministries in Tampa. Can you give us a story of a family that would be representative of what happens to these kids?
Sure. Well, you know, we've got every extreme. We've got students that, by some miracle, have maintained pretty regular enrollment and have maintained their academics through the crisis and through the trauma. And but we have many, many more who have had a number of gaps in their education. We've had we've had second graders who have been in 9 schools by the time they're in second grade. And often those 9 schools don't come in rapid succession. When we go back, we have a team of staff and volunteer support who help our children get enrolled in school. So we help them track back to get their records in place. Under McKinney-Vento, the students have a right to immediate enrollment, whether or not they have all that documentation in place. But it's important that they get that documentation in place. So it's a bit of a treasure hunt at times to go back. Students have often moved county to county, state to state, and we have to work with the family to help track those records down so we can meet the student where they are and enroll them going forward. And so I can think of a particular student that had those gaps in their education before coming to us. But then once they got enrolled, they not only stayed throughout the length of our program, which was about a year, but because of the school district support and offering ongoing transportation, that student was able to stay with us for several more years.
And How old was that student when they came to you?
The family had a number of children, and the particular student that I'm thinking about was a first grade student at the time. Had many moves, many absences.
And why had they had so many moves?
Lots of instability with employment and instability within the family situation. And the family had several children. They had 5 children. Mm-hmm. We had their younger siblings were in our preschool and were safe and were educated there. We had a first grader, and then she had an older sibling as well. They all came into our system. And then through the ongoing enrollment support, that student just completed 5th grade with us, and she's now moving on to middle school very, very successfully and in the gifted program. So it was an amazing turnaround for her and for her entire family.
Joining us from our Sarasota studio, Ellen McLaughlin is the Director of Homeless Education and the Schoolhouse Link Program at the Sarasota Y. Welcome, Ellen.
Thank you for having me.
Ellen, how big a problem is the issue of homeless students in Sarasota?
Each year we have about 1,000 homeless students identified. Those are children that are in grades K through 12. We have probably double that number that are under the age of 5, and then a pretty significant undercount, too. Many homeless kids and families are reluctant to share their situation. So there's a lot of families out there that don't say anything and don't access the help they need.
It's too complicated, possibly, for a public school to try and help the students' housing status. But how do they try to make sure that they're learning, even though they're homeless?
Every school district is required by the McKinney-Vento Act to have a homeless liaison. In Sarasota, we actually have a small team that works with homeless families. There's 4 of us. So there's one person that works with the youth, and then two people that work with family, and I do a lot of community development because it's not all about the schools. It's about community partners involved, too, to provide shelter or work opportunities or case management services. So there's, in Sarasota, the school board actually contracts with the Y to be their homeless liaison.
I've got to tell you, Ellen, I was surprised to hear that there was this program in Sarasota. You do not think of homelessness when you think of Sarasota. You think of affluence.
Sarasota is a very wealthy community. It's a beautiful place to live. But half of the kids in our school district are on free and reduced lunch. Poverty is a growing problem, and affordability of housing is a really big issue here. So, you know, our school district, like every school district, has services for homeless kids. We're just lucky to have community partners to help fill the gaps and really make a difference for our homeless families and youth.
Zach, how many parents are you working with that are employed, but they're still having trouble finding housing?
The number varies, truly. You know, we in our ability to house 24 families at capacity, these families are different walks of life.
I guess what I'm wondering is it possible that some of these parents have jobs, but they've still lost housing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of families are working and still struggling. So, you know, many times it's a temporary situation for them. And with their engagement, dialogue, and presumably the built trust that we can establish throughout the time that they were with us, you know, we can make significant strides in getting them the assistance they need. And for oftentimes, once a family is able to secure housing in the community with established resources and supports behind them, they're going to stay stably housed and independent. And that's what we're seeing a lot in our family housing program that we've sustained for several years now at HEP. We will house the families for 90 days at no charge to them, work with them on all the things we need to work on. Then once we get them established in the community, we follow them for up to a year, and we've had very, very little recidivism towards homelessness.
Since the show on homelessness among Florida students first aired, Michelle Holmes finished the 6-week job training course through the Homeless Empowerment Program. She's been working full-time as a receptionist at a medical office for the last 3 months. Michelle and her children, Noah and Emma, are living in a private apartment on the HEP campus in Clearwater. Both children are now excelling in school. Tampa International Airport is currently in the middle of a major expansion under a $1 billion master plan. For Florida Matters Newsmaker Special, Airport CEO Joe Lupano joined us to talk about those changes and answer another burning question. Is it TPA or TIA?
It goes by both, but the official FAA designation is TPA.
Yeah.
So the code is KTPA for aviators. But the Tampa International Airport, people shorten that to TIA. So we basically go by both.
By both, okay. Seems like most folks, now this is anecdotal on my part, most folks in this area still think of Orlando when it comes to international flights. They've scheduled nonstop flights to 50 destinations throughout the year. Some of them are seasonal. Is Orlando your main competitor?
Yeah, it is. And over the years, I would say that Tampa should have been trying harder to get more international flights and just did not, and Orlando was the beneficiary of that. We're now very, very competitive. We're out marketing to every airline that could serve the market. And in fact, Disney is only 1 hour away from us. So Edelweiss, as an example, used to fly to Orlando. They switched over to Tampa. They took their flight and brought it to Tampa instead.
Well, how do you make that argument? How do you sell an airline on Tampa over what is arguably the biggest tourist destination in the nation?
Yeah, it's sort of a balance. What we can sell is that you're an hour away from Disney and you're an hour away from Sarasota and Anna Maria and Clearwater and the beaches. So you can get both when you fly into Tampa. You can have a week on the beach and you can drive to see Disney, whatever you want to do.
I love the presence of the Bay Area when you're in the airport and when you arrive and you're going down to pick up your bags, the big displays there, which, by the way, thank you for updating those. It now shows me where my where my carousel is for my baggage. It used to kind of have a delay on that. It looks like that was fixed recently.
My pleasure.
But the presence of that Tampa flavor, Cigar City Brewery, the Columbia Restaurant, that's all part of the airport experience here.
Yeah, I think it's important for us. In fact, when I first got here, we had no local concepts out in the terminals at all. And then we put in Cigar City Brewery. We put in Mise en Place. We put in the Green Iguana. So we've started down that roadway now with our new concessions program, which we're in the process of developing right now, implementing. We're going to have 40% of the concepts are going to be locally based. So there's two great benefits to that. One is people get to understand what Tampa's about. Once they get to the airport, they can realize all the things we have. The other is the money that gets made stays in Tampa. Those businesses are Tampa-based businesses, and the money stays in our community.
What sort of feedback do you get from passengers? And you can share the negative as well as the positive as far as the airport experience.
The only negatives I've heard is that we play the music too loud. And so I'm not sure whether that's the hearing aid was turned on too loud or maybe we are playing it too loud. Sometimes we do have aberrations between terminals. But what we always hear is that people like the convenience and the cleanliness. Those are the two top positive comments we always get. And I used to fly through Tampa before I got this job, and I always commented on how clean the buildings were.
What is the master plan project?
Yeah, the master plan projects are intended to give us a 20-year window of growth. We're building a 2 million square foot rental car center. We're expanding our main terminal by 50,000 square feet, and we're going to connect it all together with a 1.4-mile automated people mover system. So the people mover train will leave right from the main terminal, and you'll go down to the economy garage, and you'll have the first stop will be economy garage, and then you go on to the rental car center where we'll have a state-of-the-art, probably the best rental car experience of any airport in the world. And that'll all be completed by October of 2017.
The people mover will be just continuous trains in a way, or will it be?
Yeah, it's going to be a 1.4-mile train, mm-hmm. and it allows us to take 2.3 million car trips off our roadways. So instead of widening our roadways, we're taking the cars off the roadways by moving the rental car operation to the south.
Mm-hmm.
This people mover system will run every 2 or 3 minutes and will stop at the economy parking garage. So it's going to be a great customer experience.
Joe Lupano, the CEO of Tampa International Airport, our newsmaker. Thank you so much for joining us here on Florida Matters.
My pleasure. Thank you, Carson.
And that's it for today's show. Coming up on Tuesday, December 29th, we're featuring an encore presentation of our town hall discussion on the rising tide of HIV infections in Florida. That is next Tuesday afternoon at 6:30. Florida Matters is produced by Lottie Watts. Our engineer is Craig George. Our program is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Carson Cooper. Thanks for listening.